Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Wayne Pease began his career as a forest fire lookout in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in 1962. He is a poet, playwright, and traveler who has lived in Greece, Germany, and England. To write his book, Cloud Watcher, a fire lookout's book of days, he combined the events of several fire seasons into one, making it a diary in the tradition of Thoreau's Walden. Alone most of the time with his cat, he lives through storms, fires, and tourists while he struggles with the future course of his life and internal strife in the Forest Service. Wayne Pease, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I might notice, just in case people are hearing, your last name is P-E-A-C-E.
P-E-A-S-E. Right? Yes. I know. It's always misspelled.
So Pease.
Yeah, Pease.
That does help.
That does help.
But it's a nice name if your last name is like Pease.
Well, it is unless you're a kid and they're always saying Wayne Pease. I mean, it's like...
Well, I think, I don't know if I'm typical, but I used to wonder, how can somebody sit up in that tower all by themselves day after day? It must be a special kind of person. So when did you know you were the kind of person that could do that?
Well, I don't know that I knew I'd do it, but first went to Lookout when I was 11 down in Pinnacles National Monument. And we hiked up to Lookout, and the guy had a ham radio as well as this incredible view. And I thought, oh, I can talk to the whole world and see everything up here. So that stuck in my mind. And then at 17, I applied in Montana, did not get a job. And then when I was 20...
Well, did they say you were too young? I mean, a 17-year-old?
Yeah, well, probably at that time, yeah. Mm-hmm. They may have said that. And then when I was 22, I was just about to get out of college, and I went to visit my mother up in Placerville in a campground. And the guy in the campground said, oh, somebody decided not to come to a lookout. This is in June. I mean, you know, so the season's starting. And so I went and applied, and I got it that day.
So in one day, you're suddenly right. A fire lookout.
Yeah, yeah. And it was much harder in the early days when you're young. You know, you want to be out carousing. And so, after 4 years, I took 2 years off and lived in Europe. But then I came back and started where I am now and have done it ever since.
Well, were you born in California?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But my father was in the Army, and we moved around and lived in Utah, Montana, all kinds of places, yeah.
So you had a chance to sample other places and consider what you wanted to do with your life.
Yeah.
And the thing about a fire lookout is it is seasonal, so mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have to miss college or miss these
right.
other things. So you started at what age then did you actually have your first job?
22.
At 22. So here you are, a 22-year-old.
Right.
And what kind of preparation did you have to go up into a tower?
Oh, zero. They just put me up there.
Okay.
And basically give you, you know, the job itself is pretty simple as far as reporting fires. I mean, you have this fire finder, you aim it like a compass, you take a reading. You figure out how far away it is and call it in. And then they want to know what the smoke is doing. You know, is it, what color is it? Is it getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Those kinds of things. So in terms of the actual job, your main thing is staying awake and observant. I mean, that's, but I've always been a kid in class who looked out the window all the time. And so now I get paid for looking out the window, and I thought, wow, this is great. Also, I wanted to read. I wanted to be a writer, and so I wanted time to myself. And that was the other thing that kept me going for a long time.
Well, you describe this. I know in reading your book that some of these names, I thought, okay, the guy's name is not Xanadu.
Oh, no, I changed them all.
You say that you call the game warden Xanadu. I mean, most people would change the name Joe Smith or something
right.
But you name your characters rather creatively.
Thank you.
And you do say that names have been changed, time revamped, and places altered to protect the innocent and the guilty. And to give this story the air of a fairy tale.
Hmm.
So in what regard did you consider your story a fairy tale?
Well, a lot of the things that happened, I mean, I just described, I remember, what was it? Some hang gliders just coming around the lookout and then disappearing. Or other things like once they were searching for, around my lookout, my first lookout, they were searching for some bank robbers and they were flying helicopters around. And then these guys showed up in a car and said they were lost going to Lake Tahoe, but they sure looked like bank robbers. So I called that in. But you have all these little bits of things that are sort of out of space. I mean, people said, told me they saw, you know, spaceships over my lookout. I never saw them, but I was told, yeah, one was hovering over my lookout one night by another lookout. So it has that fragmentary. I think when you, one thing is that I read our minds wander 30% of the time.
And some of us more than that.
And so a lot of this is daydreaming. And what happens is that you get so used to the landscape, even though you're daydreaming, you're not thinking about it. If a smoke shows up, it just goes off like radar. In other words, you're so attuned to that that no matter what your thoughts are at the time, it breaks through that. Yes. And so I think that was a lot of it. I was thinking one of the great pleasures in life is just daydreaming. I mean, if you have the time to daydream, you're lucky.
And you also include a lot of your nighttime dreams, your actual dreams,
yeah,
in the story.
Yeah.
Well, you include a historical note in the front of your book,
mm-hmm,
because I remember growing up seeing these fire towers as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you said the use of lookouts, and that this term can denote either the person or the structure, in the forests of Canada and the United States begin in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if most people realize it goes back, they go back that, mm-hmm, far. The first lookout towers were platforms mounted in trees.
Yeah.
Well, the trees, even tall trees, are not that high.
Well, they'd cut down all the rest of the trees and leave one tall one. That'd be basically it. Yeah.
And you say these were followed by simple structures used primarily by patrolmen as observation points on their routes. Gradually, mm-hmm, they were converted into permanent lookout stations, tall steel towers or two-story buildings with telephone connections to the dispatcher's headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
The number of lookout towers used in the state forestry departments and the national forest increased steadily until 1953, when they reached a peak of 5,060 towers. Since that time, there's been a steady decrease. And conversely, the number of aircraft used for fire detection has rapidly increased.
Mm.
So it is surprising that they're even in existence at all still, because we have other technology now.
Oh, yeah. Well, if I first got the job, everybody said, oh, this is not going to last. It's almost finished. And that was, you know, over 50 years ago.
Because you say that they had already, by the time you were hired in 1962, mm-hmm, these had already peaked.
Pretty much.
The number of fire towers.
Yeah, the forest I'm on now used to have 26. It now has 6. And so they have, in other words, the idea was if two people can see it and they give two different readings, where they cross is where the fire is. Then they started using helicopters to chase them. And the main thing is that lookouts are really cheap to run, okay? I get, after 55 years, I get basic.
55 years, in case people miss that. 55 years.
Yeah, I get, whatever you call it, is your basic $15 an hour.
But it surprised me, too, that they pay you for 8 hours. Well, you don't just go off if you see you see a fire after an 8-hour shift. You're going to still report it.
Right.
So that is kind of odd that they say, okay, we'll pay him for 8-hour day.
Yeah. Well, they assume that the temperature will go down, the humidity will go up. Mm-hmm. I've picked up a lot of fires after hours, mm-hmm, and it's nice because I get paid overtime for that. So I keep an eye on. Well, I just always kept the habit, no matter how long I'm up there, of sort of every night when I get up, I look around. So I picked up a lot of fires at night that way. It's yeah, I just wish there were a lot more lookouts than there are right now. The state used to have a whole mess of them, and they closed them all about 2003, all of them. That was like 80 lookouts or something. And the rationale is that, you know, people on the ground are going to report them and so forth. But where I am, people on the ground can't see more than, you know, the side of the highway. So I'm very, of course, very much pro lookout. There is a National Fire Lookout Association, which revamps lookouts and promotes them. I read recently that PG&E wants to install a fire camera that costs $700,000. That would probably build a whole lookout system and run it for 100 years. So it's the whole thing is that technology is going to take care of us. Well, technology is going to be probably our problem. And that it doesn't, technology is not going to take care of us. Airplanes cost a lot more than, and think about it, you got an airplane up there maybe flying this part of the forest, it takes an hour to get over to the other part of the forest and so forth. So anyway, I have lots of arguments to keep lookouts going.
Well, here's the way the job is described in a handbook. Mm-hmm. Lookouts are the eyes of the Forest Service. They're responsible for the early detection, accurate reporting of all forest fire outbreaks in an assigned area. And then it goes on to say, the lookout's lot is a lonely one. The forestry, radio, and telephone are his only link to the outside world, and visitors appear rarely. Depending on his own resourcefulness and his ability to organize his own life, the person who can appreciate the advantages will find this work as a rewarding experience, as documented by the lookouts who have come back for many seasons and for whom the tower has become a second home. This certainly proved true for me. Because if it didn't have these rewards, you wouldn't have come back.
No,
55 years.
Well, I think the you really have to have a way of preoccupying yourself. You know, I mean, and so I wanted to read, and that was started when I was in like third grade, and so you know, one summer I read like 71 books about all kinds of things. Another summer I read 44 books by Jung. You know, when I was interested in Jung, and so if you're a researcher, it's great, and then. What's really changed and improved things is, of course, cell phones. You're much more connected now. But the internet, I have a 100 feet away. I now have a Verizon tower. And so I'm actually where I started in that the guy had a ham radio and could talk to the whole world. Well, now I can be up there and be related to the whole world. So that part of it... has changed, and I tend to get more visitors now and so forth. But
yeah, I noticed that it says, because you seem to have a good many visitors,
yeah.
In this, the book, in your book, it says the lookout's lot is a lonely one and that visitors rarely appear.
Mm-hmm.
But from reading your book, I thought, well, he has visitors fairly often.
Well, the first years
but
I didn't.
But it's compressed now. You do say that these were several seasons that,
right.
Like Thoreau, compressed his stay at Walden into 1 year.
Yes.
One season.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you did. But still, it seemed like you had... visitors fairly.
Well,
often.
The first years I didn't very much. I don't know if I write about that. The first years were very different because one thing, I was a long way from, I was 50 miles from the highway. It was a dirt road. People didn't get up there that much, sometimes during hunting season and so forth. When they did get up there, I hid away from them so I didn't have to talk to them because I'd get really withdrawn those first years.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, more of my conversation with Wayne Pease, poet, playwright, and traveler. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is forest fire lookout Wayne Pease, author of Cloud Watcher, A Fire Lookout's Book of Days. On day 11 mm-hmm. in your book, you say, I think my days as a lookout are numbered. I enumerate my positive feelings about the job. So mm-hmm. here you list what you like about the job. You say, I like being in nature. Mm-hmm. It gives me peace. I like the drama of the sky and clouds, the sun and moon coming up and down, the view. I'm doing a job. It connects me with other people. I like picking up fires. I like the drama. And I'm recognized for my skills. This is my home, a place to call my own. A paycheck supports my writing and travel habits. While I'm here, I can't spend money. It's a creative space. I have time to read and think. I like myself better by the end of the summer. It's a meditation retreat, renewing my sense of identity.
Mm. Still works that way. I mean, there are things like Amazon. I spend a lot more money now during
the
summer.
Do they deliver? No, but I pick it up
when I come to town. You know, so I always buy too many books, other things as well. And then for about 15 years, I got into photography, and I spent a fortune on cameras and stuff. And finally, I dumped all those, and I used my iPhone, and I'm perfectly happy.
They can make movies now with just an iPhone.
Yeah, and I just came back from a month in Mexico City and took hundreds of pictures, and I'm perfectly satisfied with them. So spending $40,000 on equipment did not do me any good.
My guest
kept me poor.
My guest is Wayne Pease, and he has written a book, Cloud Watcher, A Fire Lookout's Book of Days. And you just listed all the things that you like about this job, and they must have overcome any disadvantages because of the fact that you continue to do this year after year. And I think a lot of what you list as the advantages would appeal to a lot of us. Being out in nature, and you say you like the peacefulness of that, the sky and the clouds, and that you say, this is my home, a place to call my own, because you said your dad was in the military, so you moved a lot, I assume, in that.
Right.
And then you spend a season in the lookout tower, and then you travel. You have traveled over 40 countries, I think, and you've lived in some of them. So because you like to travel, I assume that you don't actually – have you ever bought a house?
Oh, no. I had several decisions I made when I was, like, probably 17. One of them was never buy a house, okay. The other one is the most important, and it is not have children. Having children is the biggest decision anybody can make. And once they have children, life is out of control a lot more. So if you don't have children. So anyway, that was one of my decisions. It was because partly my family.
So you're not even out of your teens, and you're saying two things. I'm not going to have a house. I'm not going to have kids.
Right. And the other thing was not watch television. So at 17, I stopped watching television. I didn't watch it for, you know, I look at things on the web. In this book, I had actually had a TV for a while, so there's TV in it. But I figured you either watch TV or do something else with your life. And that was at 17. So I'd say to everybody, if you make, there are certain decisions you can make when you're young that are going to really either help you or hinder you as you go along. But those have been really good. I never would have been a good father. I'm not. I can't pay that much attention to another person. Obviously, I'm spending everybody by myself. And in terms of, what's the other one? Buying a house. Everybody I know who buys a house is you don't buy a house. A house buys you. And from then on, you're fixing the roof. You're fixing the sewer. It's a big drain. So
I called a plumber this morning.
Did you? So anyway, those decisions have really helped me a lot over time. And so...
So even though you're at a job that doesn't pay very much, you don't need very much because you don't have these huge expenses that you just mentioned.
Right.
Children, they sometimes give totals as to how, what a child costs.
Right.
And a house is the other huge expense. So if you can get by without those two things, then you do have the wherewithal to travel, it seems to me. No.
Well, I think you're just a lot more independent in general. You know, you don't have to rely on other people to make decisions and so forth. I've traveled with people and I enjoyed it, certain people. And so you are making mutual decisions and so forth. But I think my part of it is just being life being out of your control. It really spins out with those things.
Well, one thing that I noticed too is that you travel to, say, Pasternak's grave.
Oh, or, yeah, that was.
Name some of these Russian writers that you go visit.
Some of the coincidences have been amazing to me. And that was one. A friend and I went to Petersburg and Moscow. I stopped at this, there was a corner where some guys were selling books. And so I started talking to them. They were Russian. They were both poets.
They spoke English.
And they spoke English, right. And it turns out one of them worked as a guide at Pasternak's house. Okay, so he invited me out there the next day to go out to Pasternak's house when it wasn't open to anybody else. And, of course, he had to convince the people, caretakers there. And so I had this whole day at Pasternak's house. And I'd always, that novel had always had a big effect on me. It's the story of a poet. You know, it's...
You might mention, you would say that novel, you mean...
Dr. Zhivago.
Yes.
So, and I took along a little bottle of vodka and some cups. I didn't tell them, but we went out to Pasternak's grave, so I pulled out the cups, and we all had vodka. And I mentioned to one of them, my favorite poem, and so he recited it from memory. It's about a candle burned on the table, and it's at the end of Dr. Zhivago. So... I've had all kinds of coincidences like that, that somehow you don't know if they're fated or just you're sending things out or you're pulling things to you, but lots of things happen that you just don't expect when you're on your own.
But writers do play a role in your choices when you travel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
are some others that most people wouldn't say, oh, I think I'll go to Pasternak's house?
Oh, I've been to Strindberg's house in Stockholm. One time I got a book on where people lived in Paris. And so I just went with that book, and I went to all these different places where Hemingway lived and Joyce lived and Gertrude Stein and so forth. In fact, that was my reason for... doing a lot of things was, I thought, okay, well, poets really do this. They go places. They honor other poets. They see what the world is like, and they have things happen to them. So in a way, it turned out to be an excuse just to wander around. I felt that in Mexico City. I went there to see museums, but probably after a month there, the biggest effect was just wandering around the streets, especially during Day of the Dead, and thousands of people around you, and you just sort of absorb the atmosphere. And so I think that's part of traveling for me. The writers are an excuse.
Well, you mentioned that the last line in Dr. Zhivago, and he quoted it. And I don't know about you, but I find it thrilling that sometimes, like in Paris, there's a bridge called Mirabeau, and there's a poem, Sous le pont Mirabeau. And sometimes if I start reciting that, a Frenchman will join in with me. And it's for me, it's thrilling to share this culture. I don't know if it was for you, say, when you're traveling. So here's a person on the other side of the world who has read this book and who is thrilled about it as I am and can quote from this book.
Well, that's one thing about if you travel cheap, you end up meeting a lot of people.
You're not going to find them in the Ritz Hotel.
No. I mean, the one I just stayed in, I stayed in a 16-bedroom for a month. You know, there were all kinds of people, all kinds of languages, everybody going through. It's harder to meet people today because everybody's looking at their cell phone. This is everywhere. And a couple will sit down at the table. They're having dinner. The first thing they do is both of them pull out their cell phone. So you have kind of a screen there that wasn't there before. Because you meet people from Australia, whatever. And you're much more likely to find people like that in that situation.
My guest is Wayne Pease, and he has written a book, Cloud Watcher, a fire lookout's book of days. And your work is seasonal, so that leaves you time to travel to all these various places. And I imagine, because you mentioned you don't have TV and you're reading books, you say that being in nature gives you peace when you're out there in nature. But I was thinking as you were describing that I think if you're out of touch with world news and U.S. news, that would allow you to be more peaceful than those of us who follow the news.
Yeah, no, most of the news is speculation. 80% is speculation. What might happen? You don't get any news. You constantly have this fear brought up of what might happen. and the actual facts are almost non-existent. So, and TV in general also with the ads and everything just keeps you hyped up. It constantly works on your nerves. If you just listen to an ad, you feel how it's raising your temperature level. And also, I think it's hypnotizing you at the same time. I think hypnosis is one of the secrets of life, and it's we're always hypnotizing ourselves, and that the main way we change ourselves is we go to a therapist and we get a different story about ourselves. We switch our story. Or the same thing with art. I think all of art really switches you into somebody else's thinking, and it's like a little vacation from yourself. It may not change you, but for that time, it's a vacation from this hypnosis. So so I think that's basically we're in a trance most of the time. And the TV especially would be made there to trance you into buying things. But when I've worked in theater, they say that toward the end of a play, you want everybody in the audience to go into a trance for 20 minutes. That's your goal, just before the end of it. And this happens, I think, with movies. I think it happens if you think about reading a book. The repetition of a lot of things. You go into another world, and so your own thoughts are forming in different ways than they normally do. As soon as you close the book, you're back, or you wake up in the morning, you're back in your world of yourself. And so it's very hard to shake yourself unless you have brain damage. That's the one thing that will change people. For sure.
Well, you mentioned meditation, and several times in your book, you mentioned meditation or yoga, and you tell a little, you'll insert a little Zen story in your that day's recounting of what that day was like. Where does all this come from?
Well, I've gone through periods of, number one, of Zen and shamanism. I was really interested in that in probably my 20s, and even now I'll go back and read a Zen book and so forth. Now, the one thing that I've tried not to do is adopt any particular system. In other words, most people, or a lot of people, I shouldn't say most, will adopt one system. And they'll read everything in Zen. They'll go to Zen Buddhism things. That's like buying a Harley Davidson. You buy a Harley Davidson.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody compare Zen to a Harley Davidson.
It's the same thing. You're immersing yourself in a system. So you buy that, you ride with other guys, but the main thing is you trick out your whole thing, your whole bike, with different things. And when they go to these rallies, everybody's looking at everybody's bike to see how they tricked it out. Well, you can spend your whole life thinking and being inside Harley Davidson. You can do the same thing with Zen meditation. You can go to monasteries. And so any system that you adopt is security, but it's also a limitation. And so you're limited to say the way the Bible says things. And you see people writing notes in Bibles for years in cafes and stuff. Same thing. They're obsessed with that system or that particular way of looking at things. And so anyway, I've tried to break that and not do that. So sometimes I've gone through long periods of yoga, meditation, therapy. I've been to all kinds of therapies.
In fact, at one point you say, I could have saved myself a lot of money if I just read this $4.95 self-help book instead of going to all that therapy.
Yeah, I was thinking of one today that actually, you know, you talk about books changing your life, but I have one that actually did. And that was, I used to get in a lot of trouble by being a savior and trying to save other people who were in trouble, particularly people on drugs or whatever. And I always got them in more trouble. And then I read a book called When Helping Others is Hurting Yourself. And that was all about how we're trained to be saviors, usually by a parent who confides everything in us and we become their savior. My mother was sick a lot when I was young. And so you're trained to be a savior. And I gave it up finally, and it was much better for other people, but I think I did a lot
better for other people for you to quit trying to help them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I did a lot of bad stuff with trying
to
help
people.
With
best intentions.
With best intentions, yeah. Yeah. So by getting out of that mode, I realized what was going on. And a therapist once said, oh, your mother and your sister really trained you to take care of women, you know.
My guest is Wayne Pease, and he spent 55 years as a fire lookout, and he has written a book, Cloud Watcher, a fire lookout's book of days, and you number the days that you describe.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just talking about the fact that you don't follow one narrow path, if I may put it that way.
Right.
And don't you think it's probably because of all the world travel you've done that you see there are other ways of seeing the world, of looking at things?
I think that might be true. It may be more a reaction to other people who get on a one-track way of thinking.
And you really say, annoys I don't want to me. Be that way.
Yeah. It really annoys
because
me.
Because they think their way is the way?
Oh, always, always. And you really can't convince somebody like that. You spend a lot of time trying to change their mind. Forget it. They're locked into this whole system. And that's what I said, like self-hypnosis. We're locked into our own way of thinking.
And probably the danger is that we don't realize it.
Oh, no.
So we're at the mercy of
this. We think that's our personality. We think that's us, you know. And so it's very hard to let go of those things. And so usually you need help. I just listened to a book that was called How to Change Your Mind. And it's by Michael Pollan. And it's about the recent use of psychedelics in therapy, where you actually work with a therapist, they give you a psychedelic thing, and it gives you a completely different experience of yourself. I think that's the main thing. He talks about how, you know, you love everybody and so forth, but I think the main thing is it takes you on a different track. And so you've had an experience that's really outside yourself and your own experience. And so it can have long-lasting ramifications. So that's one way you can do it. Another way is you can travel the world. You can fall in love. I mean, there are lots of ways. But, we're locked into ourselves and we don't know it.
Well, at one point in your book, you say, yeah, look out, crack up. Do
oh,
people
yeah.
ever think you've cracked up, Wayne?
No, but I've had one lookout jump off a lookout, kill himself. Another one I don't know if I put it in there, but it's my boss told me about a story where one time they heard this guitar playing on the radio early in the morning, and they couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And finally they figured out, and the guy reported seeing a dragon going through the lake below him and things like that. They finally figured out who it was, and it was one of the lookouts. And when they got up, they found out his wife had committed suicide this summer, the winter before. And so this guy went off the deep edge. Being alone is not what, you know, people talk about the benefits of solitude. I think it's more like Jung said, he wouldn't analyze some people because they were on the edge of psychosis. He would not analyze them because it would push them into psychosis. And I think the same with solitude. Solitude is not for everybody and not to be taken lightly. So it does take a particular kind of person. That's what you said before. And they do come back year after year.
Well, you say so many people say to me, as their children are running around crazy, you said, these people, you say, many people say this, I always wanted to do something like this. But then I got married.
Well, and that's part of having kids. Yeah, you got married. People say that a lot, and it's true. The other is, though, that a lot of people say they'd like to do it, but the Forest Service guys I work for, they don't like being stuck on a lookout. They want to be out fighting fires. They want to be in action. So lookout is really more for a contemplative kind of person. And so that's why somebody who reads, somebody who paints,
who writes poems?
Who writes
like
poems?
You do.
Yeah. You have a kind of, as I say, again, it's kind of fairy tale. You're living. I read a lot of fairy tales when I was a kid. I just saw a sign in the library. Said, "What did you want to be when you were five?" And almost everybody put down dinosaur. That was the answers. But at five, I was reading all kinds of picture books, and as well as playing in the woods by myself. Now, my mother said when I was little, I played so much alone, she didn't think I would have any friends or I would have anything to do with people. So she was happy when she found out I had a few friends. But evidently, that was there from the beginning,
yeah.
Before I was aware
that you
of
were,
it.
Even as a kid, you were right. Content with your own company.
Yep. And also in my grades, when I look at my early first and second grade report cards, everything is good except working with other people. I always got a D in those.
Goodness. My guest is a veteran fire lookout, Wayne Pease, author of Cloud Watcher, a fire lookout's book of days. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is fire lookout Wayne Pease, author of Cloud Watcher, a fire lookout's book of days. Tourists invade my space, not to mention the occasional rattlesnake. Now, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
So these are some of the things you say you don't care for, things you don't like about the job. But one of them is that you have to leave at the end of the season.
Well, I was thinking about what I found out. One, the most used word in English is time. I never knew that. And I was reading about time the other day. And I think the main thing with me is the evanescence of things. And so it's just an awareness of time. I had a therapist who said I was too impressed by death when I was young. And that was being around probably my father's funerals. One friend of mine was killed when I was 11. That was not long after I first went to the lookout. We were playing one day. This is in Indiana. And he was putting lighter fluid on his pants, lighting it and then putting it out. Well, the next day he got killed walking down the street. A kid was up in his room cleaning his 22. 22 went off and hit this kid in the jugular vein. So the next time I saw that kid was in his coffin in the living room. And he had a glass coffin. He was all dolled up, you know, with makeup and every kinds of things. And there were all these women in black around the room. This is in his living room. And all of a sudden I got very afraid. And I ran out of there. So the whole thing of time and death has always been a problem. And so I think that's one reason I wrote Day by Day was probably time and measuring time passing.
Well, do you know, as you say that people are preoccupied with time, I remember in college there was a psychology class, and the professor said, fill in the end of this sentence. Mostly I worry about... And I filled in that sentence with having enough time to do everything I have to do. I have been concerned about time as far back as I can remember. Mm. I'm trying to get better about it. Mm-hmm. But I always wore a watch, and I was always worried about, am I going to have time to get this done? I've got to get this done now, no matter what it was. And so I, too, was preoccupied with time. I'm trying to get over it. But I didn't realize that was a concern for
everybody. Yeah, Deepak Chopra, one thing he said is about getting older, the two things you worry about is what other people think of you, because you don't feel old to yourself. That's what Oscar Wilde said, when you get old, you won't feel old. But when you look in the mirror, you see. And then the other thing is, will you have time? And the decrease in time. So you can look up things and there are a lot of sayings about you'll have time. You have plenty of time to do whatever you want. Doesn't matter when it is.
In fact, that's what I changed my thinking around.
Oh.
To my little mantra to tell myself, I've got plenty of time.
Mm.
And so time became not something that was limited for me, because that's the way I always viewed it. And it really helps.
Well, I was looking at another Zen book the other day. It's called Being Time. And the whole philosophy of this particular Zen was that we are time. We're not separate from time. And that everything around us is a depository of time. So time is not something we're chasing or that's chasing us. It's just here. It's like a being in the room. Well, that's easy enough to say, but to actually adopt that is pretty hard.
Well, in your book, you deal with the fact that, the Forest Service, I'm just a lowly hourly wage earner, and they don't listen to me.
Well, that still can be very true. I mean, I think I'm in a good situation because I work with a lot of good people. We had a fire bug that lit fires all around my lookout last year, and there were like 25 of them. I picked those up. And so I do get a lot of respect from them. But another lookout quit this summer when, number one, they started, for 35 years, they paid me for my lunch hours so I could keep watching through the afternoon. This year, they decided they were going to save money, and they closed all the lookouts for half an hour in the middle of the afternoon, high temperature. And this other lookout was really upset about it. And then he reported the fire, and they were saying it was someplace. And he said, no, it's somewhere else. And he said, is anybody out there listening to me? Am I speaking Russian? And he quit right there on the spot. So it can be. It's true lots of times when you start depending on all this technology, even though you have somebody up there watching, They used to call me a lot more in the middle of the night to check on things and so forth if they thought they had something. And now instead of calling me, they just send a helicopter, which every time they put it in the air, I don't know how many thousands of dollars that costs. But they really do, lots of times, forget the lookouts are up there. But it depends on your bosses. It depends on who's in dispatch. It depends on your own ability to make yourself heard. But it's... I think it's this pro-technology, anti-human thing, that everything can be replaced by machines. And I just watched a TED Talk about IA. And the thing about, he said IA is one of the things that's going to kill us because we're building bombers, drones and things that can fire their own weapons. They can choose their own targets. And so, in a sense, that's losing control of... our wartime intelligence. So anyway, we have this myth that machines are going to do it all. Somebody said Americans are in love with their machines, and I think it's true.
My guest has spent 55 years as a fire lookout. His name is Wayne Pease, and his book is Cloud Watcher, A Fire Lookout's Book of Days. And you mentioned in your book, you say, suddenly I realize all the dispatchers this year are men. And what happened to the female forest supervisor and district ranger? For 10 years, a judge in San Francisco forced the Forest Service to hire more women. Women were promoted faster, whether they were qualified or not, causing a lot of resentment among the men. 2 years ago, the judge lifted the requirement, and all the women vanished.
Well, I have to tell you, that particular thing is the reason I don't have retirement. My boss wanted to change my position to permanent yearly. But he said a woman would get the job, that they couldn't fly the job, and so a woman would get the job. So I have no retirement. So that's part of the resentment of people from that time. On the other hand, what happened was people told me they promoted women too fast who weren't qualified. And so what happened is women's kind of retreated into the background, and now they've become, as I say, the head of the Forest Service is a woman, her assistant is a woman, head of a lot of forests are women. I've had women bosses of all kinds. And so the situation is not the same as it was then. But that's why I think it receded at that time, is they tried to promote women too fast and didn't give them the basic training and a lot of the forestry things. Now that's not a problem.
Well, you continue to be a forest fire lookout, and where are you? Where do you go when you go up into your tower?
Oh, I work in Mount Huff Lookout, which is outside of Quincy, California. You can look from Quincy right up to the bluff, and you can see my lookout on the town. It's about 7 miles, I think. It's about 9 miles of dirt road. What can I say? Actually, I have a plush lookout that I'm resented by the other people because they built my lookout, revealed it 30 years ago, and they built it for the radio system. They got money. So they tore down the old one, and this is when I'm on the cover of it. I'm
looking
out.
It's the cover of your book. That's you?
Yeah, and that's while I'm looking, while they're rebuilding the lookout. And so... I have running water. They put in a new tank, so I have a tank. I have electricity because they have all the different radio sites up there for the highway patrol and so forth. So anyway, I have electricity, running water. I do use an outhouse. I don't have indoor. I do have a shower now because they put in after 20 years. They put in a big enough tank that I can actually have a shower. So I'm not suffering, I would say, in terms of comforts. On the other hand, you still just spend your time alone and you have to stay awake through the afternoon. I mean, it doesn't matter how comfortable you are. In fact, the more comfortable you are, the harder it is. I read a book, we had an essay in college called Comfort, and it was all about how comfort can ruin your life. And I've often thought, I read another one that said, everything you've ever wanted lies just outside your comfort zone. And I like that saying very much.
In fact, I've seen a cartoon where somebody's staring at a map. Maps say, you are here.
Yeah.
And somebody's standing looking at this, you are here. And then the caption said, don't get too comfortable.
And that's the part of it. I mean, I started traveling again when I was getting really depressed, just staying in Chico all the time. I was busy with theater and with photography, but then that slacked off. And so I finally took a trip to Australia a couple of years ago. And I was miserable at first. I mean, staying in dorms and all this kind of stuff. But by the end of the trip, after 3 weeks, I really enjoyed it. So the next year, I went back to Australia for a month and really enjoyed the whole thing. This time, and when I got back from that Australia trip, I thought, okay, I'm going to go to Mexico City and just sit there and go to museums, but also be uncomfortable. And I think I would give that for everybody. Everybody, once in a while, the thing about traveling is uncomfortable if you do it the right way.
Well, you've mentioned just now museums, and at one point in your book, you say, boy, too bad I couldn't get paid for going to museums.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
You have a lot of experience in
that. Oh, yeah. I suppose I could have been a museum person, and I had taken a lot of art history classes. I still do. But again, any time you take on a regular job, you're locked into a circle. So working seasonal has worked better because then it gives me the half of the year. And when I go back, it takes me 3 weeks to get used to sitting still. Not looking out the window, I get used to that real quick. But the restriction in movement, because I do a lot of walking. I mean, I do my 10,000 steps a day in Mexico City. But I do think you have to make yourself uncomfortable once in a while to wake yourself up. I mean, it's like, and get used to the fact that you can deal with it. Most of it is you start thinking about yourself as, I can't deal with that, or I can't deal with that, I can't deal with that. But if you go off and deal with it, then you realize, oh, I can. And you do, and you come back from the trip feeling a lot more confident as a person.
That's the very word that came to me as you were describing this, because I remember one spring, it was the coldest, wettest spring in south of France since 1968, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was on foot, and I thought, if I ever get warm and dry again, I'll never complain about the heat in Chico. If I can just get warm and dry again. Uh-huh. Because when you're walking, when you're on foot with a backpack.
I know.
But it also, that very thing you just said, it gave me confidence. Well, I did that. I can do that. If I'm presented with these kind of circumstances, I can do it.
Yeah. Well, one of the guys that was camping out at Walmart after the fire said, you know, homeless people live out in the rain all the time. I can live in the rain. And I thought that same thing. We forget how much we can do and how good we have it, you know, and that we're not really being tested most of the time.
Yeah, you become so grateful for a warm, dry place to sleep at night.
Yeah.
And just a warm, dry place. We're so grateful.
Right. And that's something that I think that the thing of gratefulness is really big question. It's like, I can't be grateful very often. I do remember I got hit by a car over on Crosswalk and thrown over the car, and I had a small fracture in my foot. And for a month, everybody was helping me, and I felt grateful, which I rarely feel. I think it's very hard for most of us to feel grateful because we're so used to what we got. And it's a great feeling. But as you say, you sort of have to promote it, or you have to get it there.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Wayne, about your book. And I think you might cause people to take a look at their lives and maybe do a little thinking about that.
Well, they can get the book on Amazon. So,
So the book is Cloud Watcher, A Fire Lookout's Book of Days. Retired Professor Richard Parker was a professor of philosophy at Chico State University. He is co-author of a textbook on critical thinking, now in its 12th edition. Here's Richard Parker.
Two things today. First, about this end-of-year mail. If you're like me, much of your life is measured by how much mail you receive. And I expect the new year will be something of a relief this year. Besides the usual basketfuls of advertising that come during the Christmas season, I asked for trouble when I bought something from a catalog a month or two ago. The trouble came in the form of a blizzard of catalogs that began arriving in my mailbox. I should have known that every catalog mailer in the country talks to every other one and that they trade addresses, so you and I get the benefit of seeing every blessed one of these examples sometime between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Ending 2018 will be especially pleasant in the mail department because the excess mail season was extended backwards by November's elections. This fall, like in most even-numbered years, the box filled up with political advertisements as well as the usual ads for tools, garden implements, cleaning services, gutter maintenance, car repair, beauty products, and you can imagine what else. And the political advertisements, which I don't ordinarily pay much attention to, They had an edge to them this year that I didn't much like. In fact, many of them were nothing more than hit pieces that attacked an opponent with claims that, at least sometimes, I knew were not true. So I'm glad that's over with. I'm hoping we can now relax for a while and not have to visit the mailbox with a wheelbarrow. Instead, and this is thing two today, we can sit around and wonder how long it will take us to give up our New Year's resolutions, the ones we foolishly made at the end of 2018. I, for one, am not wasting time. I've already given up all of them except one. But it's a big one. I've decided to stop drinking. I know this will come as a surprise to a lot of my friends, since I've been known to have the occasional martini and or glass of Amador County's Zinfandel, among other restorative liquids. I've been watching my intake lately, though, as a result of my theory of alcohol attraction. The theory, incidentally, is very simple. It just says that alcohol that is inside of you exerts a powerful attraction to alcohol that is outside of you. So that second drink is straining to get in there and mix it up with the first one. See if it doesn't work the next time you lift a glass. But I'm going to stop. I'm not going to stop all at once, however. I'm going to taper off, sort of like the way some people taper off cigarettes. I'm going to give up every kind of alcoholic beverage, but I'm going to give them up one at a time. I have the immediate future pretty carefully planned, actually. For example, this winter, I will give up absinthe. The spring will see me say goodbye to grappa, and next summer, I'm going to give up white cream de mint. Single malt scotch will be next fall's deprivation, although I've never been able to afford it anyhow. So you see how it goes. I'm hoping this will be the first New Year's resolution I'm able to keep for a while. It may give me inspiration to try something even more difficult next year. I'll be open for suggestions. This is Richard Parker.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.